Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. It is the 10th of June, 2013. Today, we are joined on the line once again by the director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal, Canada, none other than Professor Michel Chossadovsky, a frequent guest on this program. Professor Chossadovsky, thank you again for your time.
Good morning.
Well, we have you here today to talk about the ongoing conflict in Syria, but I understand you are here to make the case that the destabilization, the U.S.-NATO proxy war in Syria, is coming to a conclusion of some sort, or at the very least is failing. Perhaps a provocative thing to say at this point. Let's talk a little bit about where you think the insurrection stands right now.
Well, essentially, the insurrection has been defeated. The evidence suggests that the Al-Qaeda-affiliated rebels, which essentially are the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance, have been decimated by Syrian armed forces. And in other words, the question is, what happens now? The ground war is over. The so-called international community is calling for an end to the war. But at the same time, that same international community is creating conditions for the continuation of that war. There's the issue of humanitarian aid to the refugees, to the people affected by the crisis. And again, I think what troubles me is the fact that it is the aggressor nations which are bringing the humanitarian aid to Syria, when in fact these aggressor nations are responsible for war crimes. So instead of focusing on humanitarian aid in the abstract, let us focus on the issue of war reparations. In other words, reparations by the aggressor nations to rebuild that country, to repatriate people who have been displaced to neighboring countries, to rebuild the institutions which have been destroyed, the houses, the homes of the victims of this war. In other words, the causality, the underlying causality has to be put forth. This is a war of aggression. It's well established that these foot soldiers were trained and financed by the Western Military Alliance, namely United States, NATO, and Israel. Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar played a crucial role, and of course, Israel. And we know that Israel was involved in supporting Al-Qaeda rebels in areas adjacent to the occupied areas of the Golan Heights. So on the Syria-Israeli border, so to speak, including, in fact, a hospital facility which was there to bring in the Al-Qaeda rebels who had been wounded and then send them back to the war theater. So that Israel, ironically, is supporting the Islamic Jihad, at least the military wing of the Islamic Jihad, with a view of destabilizing a sovereign state and a neighboring country of Israel.
Now, that this is a war of aggression that is being perpetrated by the actors that you've named should not come as a surprise to regular viewers of GRTV or people who regularly visit globalresearch.ca. But for people who have not been following this, let's set the scene and let's go over the fact that this has been a foreign-funded, foreign-trained, foreign-aided insurgency from the beginning, a terrorist force that's been unleashed in Syria since the very beginning of this conflict.
Absolutely. If we go back to February or January of 2011, we have, in fact, I think it was end of January, Robert Stephen Ford is appointed U.S. ambassador. I happened to be in Damascus at the time of his appointment. I spent 2 months in Syria in the 2 months preceding the outbreak of the insurrection. But Robert Stephen Ford is a very important figure in an understanding of what happened. Robert Stephen Ford was number two man in the U.S. Embassy under John Negroponte. And as we know, John Negroponte, which has a whole personal history of supporting and creating death squads going back to the heyday of Central America. He was based in Honduras. He sponsored the death squads in Honduras and in Nicaragua. So we're going back to another era. But he was brought to Iraq precisely to create those death squads and also to insert the death squads in the Iraqi police. Who was his number two man? Robert Stephen Ford. And Robert Stephen Ford, in fact, played a far more crucial role than Negroponte because he actually speaks Arabic and he speaks Turkish. And he was also in contact with the various factions in Iraq. And then Robert Stephen Ford, actually, after a stint in Algeria, turns up in Syria. And he has played, he's a very key State Department official. He played a key role in the process of recruitment of these death squads, modeled on what had been applied previously in Iraq, and also modeled on what was called the Salvador option in Central America. So it really is the application of the Salvador option to the Middle East. And if we look at the track record of the rebel forces in Syria, we can see that the same training process applied. These are killers, and they are there to kill civilians. They have a certain pattern of executing people who are Shiite or Alawite, and then they also have procedures for executing what they call the traitors within the Sunni community. And then what was applied was the concept of ethnic cleansing in all the Christian communities in Syria. So there was a very structured insurrection, which was essentially directed against the civilian population. And then what happened is that when these atrocities were committed, the Western media casually accused the Syrian government of killing its own people. The accusations were absurd, but at the time people believed them. Subsequently, many reports came through which actually contradicted this interpretation or falsification of the mainstream media. And then they started on to saying, well, they are atrocities on both sides. But the fact of the matter is that these death squads were set loose in a sovereign country with a view to destabilizing civil society. Killing people was the basis for that destabilization, the destruction of buildings and residential complexes and so on was part of it. Then we had, at a much later stage, we had the so-called chemical weapons saga. That actually is now resurfacing as a pretext for possible intervention. It is it's being used by the French as well as the British, pointing to the fact that the Syrian armed forces are using chemical weapons against their own people. But yet, if you look at the history of this so-called chemical weapons saga, you will be able to see that there are reports from very so-called authoritative sources, including CNN, which confirm not only that the rebels, Al-Qaeda rebels, Al-Nusra rebels, are in possession of chemical weapons, but they are actually being trained by Western special forces. And this is confirmed by CNN. In other words, Western special forces training the rebels, the probably say, well, it's not to train them. It's it's not to train them into using them. It's training them into familiarizing them with chemical weapons so that in the eventuality that the government has them, they would know what to do. But in fact, these al-Nusra rebels are terrorists. They're death squads. And the training that was provided to them in the use of chemical weapons is there for their use. And recently there have been other reports, even by the Turkish police, to the effect that they caught these opposition rebels with chemical weapons in their possession. It's front page news in Turkey, but here in the West, and in all the mainstream reports, it's the Syrian government which is threatening its own people with chemical weapons. Consequently, the aggressors must now come in with a humanitarian mandate to prevent the Syrian government from using chemical weapons against its people, when in fact all the evidence suggests that it is the terrorists, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated brigades that are in possession of chemical weapons.
Certainly from the point of view that this is an operation to overthrow the Assad government, the proxy war has been a failure and I think has been largely defeated. But there are those who argue that the entire purpose of the operation in Syria was not necessarily the overthrow of Assad, but the creation of just a destabilization campaign that effectively removes Syria from the playground when we talk about the pipeline politics that are going on generally in the region. Do you give that theory any credence? And if so, has this been a success in those terms?
I think we're in a situation where of unconventional covert warfare rather than the so-called blitzkrieg where you go in with a no-fly zone, an air campaign, and so on. And that is what the Western Military Alliance has chosen for Syria, is that you destabilize its economy, you impose sanctions, you block the supply of food and fuel to the population, you create havoc, you send in these killers that go into the different parts of the country and start killing people, you create a refugee crisis, and eventually the international community will pick up the pieces, and this will lead to some kind of transition. I think that position is pretty clear. That's what's happening. However, I don't think that the Western architects of this covert warfare had planned on being wiped out. They've been wiped out, so that the conditions exist today for rebuilding of that country. In the abstract, they are there because the ground war is over. What may occur would be selected terrorist attacks, but without any kind of territorial base. In other words, no enclave of or military base and command structure of any significance. So that the command structure of the Free Syrian Army has been decimated. The only force which actually remained was al-Nusra. Al-Nusra has been decimated. And what I suspect will happen is that the insurrection may continue, but with ad hoc operations in and out of Turkey or in and out of Israel and so on, but without the kind of structure which it had until recently. Now, I think that a continuation of this war going towards, let's say, a no-fly zone, using the pretext of weapons of mass destruction, at the moment is unlikely, because in the course of the last 2 years, Syria has been building up its air defense system. This is not to say that it didn't have an air defense system right from the outset. There's been much discussion on the S-300 Russian air defense system. But if you go back to 2006, you have declarations on the part of the Russian Ministry of Defense to the effect that they intend to station S-300 in southern Syria at the naval port of Tartus. And they say this is our initiative to protect our naval base. In the course of the last 18 months, there have been reports of Russian advisors in air defense, components coming in, essentially coming in through the port of, through the naval facility in Tartus. Everything leads us to the obvious that the S-300 is already installed and was already installed prior to the lifting of the EU arms embargo directed against Syria. And then Vladimir Putin just took the opportunity of stating what was already de facto. He said, well, we're going to deliver the S-300 to Syria, when in fact the S-300 is already in place. So that Syria has a sophisticated air defense system. It has Russian and Iranian advisors. This is well established. It would be very unwise for the Western military alliance to go to the next step and start threatening an air campaign. And on the ground, the war is over. So that in effect, they're in an impasse. But I think there are many options which, of course, are being contemplated. And they're being contemplated in the context of the broader war. We must understand that the war in Syria is part of a military roadmap. The road to Tehran goes through Damascus. And whatever military actions are taken against Syria, they are also taken in relation to actions directed against Iran. There's an integrated process of military planning. That's what people must understand. The United States and its allies, including Israel, don't simply have, let's say, three or four different war plans. They have one war plan, which is global warfare. And in the Middle East, there's a regional war theater where all these different options are examined, simulated with various scenarios. That's what they do. They put it onto the computers and so on. So that the project of destabilizing Iran with very drastic economic sanctions is part of the broader equation. So that what Syria is being subjected to sanctions, Syria's economy has been destroyed, its population has been displaced, and as you suggested, this is really the agenda. It's the agenda of weakening, destabilizing, and destroying, killing a nation, and then eventually leading up to some kind of negotiations. The other avenue is also the extension of the war into Lebanon, which we're seeing now. The sectarian violence is triggered. It's part of covert operations as well. But we must, I think, also recognize the historic nature of this conflict, of this war. The Syrian government has won the war. And they've won the war against the most powerful military alliance on planet Earth, which is funding their Al-Qaeda foot soldiers. We also have to, all this depends on propaganda and counter-propaganda, you know, develop in the course of the next few months. Counter-propaganda is very important, and that's the whole basis of this interview. We have seen some very disturbing pictures, and if the broad American public come to realize the implications, I think it's very important. John Kerry negotiates directly with the commanders of Al-Qaeda. Okay? He meets up with with, well, theoretically is the Free Syrian Army, but in fact, the Free Syrian Army is non-existent. The only fighting force is al-Nusra. So that the commander of the Free Syrian Army links up with John Kerry. John Kerry said, we're going to support you. We're going to give you money. We're going to send in military advisors and so on. What the U.S. public and people around the world should realize is that the U.S. Secretary of State is not only involved in a blatant violation of international law by supporting an insurgency within a sovereign country. It's a war crime. But he is also in blatant violation of U.S. anti-terrorist legislation. Okay? Anybody who has any kind of remote contact with an Al-Qaeda-affiliated operative is immediately considered as a suspect and would normally be arrested by the FBI. Okay? Look at the fate of the, you know, of the Tsarnaev brothers in the Boston bombings. Now, if John Kerry or Senator John McCain have links with leaders of a terrorist organization, which is on the State Department blacklist, one would assume that they should be given the same kind of treatment as any citizen of the U.S. which has a link with Al-Qaeda, okay? Double standards. John Kerry is Secretary of State, yet the U.S. State Department says that al-Nusra is an illegal terrorist organization, but this doesn't prevent John Kerry from funding money to al-Nusra on behalf of the U.S. government, okay? So then it raises the broader issue of the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the U.S. government or U.S. intelligence, something which we have known for at least 30 years, that Al-Qaeda is a creation of the CIA, yet everybody says, oh, it's a blowback. They turned against us, okay? We helped to create them back in the heyday of the Soviet-Afghan war. They've turned against us, et cetera, et cetera. No, there hasn't been a single moment in the last 30 years that the CIA has broken its link with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's intelligence asset, and the recent developments show unequivocally that there is an interface between agencies of the U.S. government, including the U.S. State Department, and these Al-Qaeda-affiliated formations, which are trained and recruited in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and funded from various sources, including the United States, NATO, Israel, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey. And that has to be addressed, okay? You can't, because that makes the whole structure of the global war on terrorism topple. You can't, you can't wage a global war on terrorism and then ask the terrorists to do it for you, okay? So in effect, what we now see is very visibly, not and in a way which we've never seen it before, is that the United States government is the terror state, because it is not only training Al-Qaeda, financing Al-Qaeda, but it is also interfacing on a regular basis with Al-Qaeda. We're senior members of the administration and of the U.S. Senate go in and start chatting with Al-Qaeda affiliates. And then, is that a new normal? Well, if it's a new normal, I think what we have to do is to reveal that this new normal is a criminal project. You can't wage a war on terrorism and then have an amicable financial arrangement with these terrorists and use them as your foot soldiers to wage your wars of conquest. So then, what I'm saying there is that the global war on terrorism as a structure, as a concept, is starting to tumble down.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think you're right that the new part of this is not that Al-Qaeda is intimately in bed with the intelligence. Of course, as you point out, that's been the case all along. But what is new here is that it's now out in the open. They are negotiating with and using and posing for photo opportunities. In Senator John McCain's case, literally posing for photo opportunities with known kidnappers and terrorists, and it makes barely a mention in the news. So we have entered a sort of new normal, and it's a question of how this or whether this will be extended. But you bring up some very important points. Of course, by the entire apparatus of the war on terror, people like John McCain and John Kerry should be thrown in jail for conspiring with terrorist groups, and there should be the question of war reparations for the damage that's been done in Syria. But there is a vast gulf, to be sure, between where we are right now and the possibility of implementing these types of things. Is that a possibility? And if so, how do we possibly get there from where we are right now?
Well, I think the main issue is to break the media propaganda apparatus. Because at this stage, the media bears a responsibility. It's a criminal project. War propaganda is criminal under the Nuremberg Protocol. By obfuscating the truth, they are also complicit in war crimes. But I think that there is an opportunity at this stage to effectively confront the media. And it's also an opportunity for people to turn away from the mainstream media. But I should mention this, there's another dimension, if we're talking about the independent media or the alternative media, that there's a lot of ambiguity in so-called progressive media on the internet in particular. And we noticed that some prominent voices of so-called progressives were supportive of the NATO bombings in Libya, for instance. We also noticed that there's some prominent voices and media which have supported the war in Syria, and it disturbs me that the World Social Forum, which is supposed to be the regrouping of thousands of progressives, and which recently met in Tunis, was integrated by intellectuals, militants, NGOs, which were actually supporting the so-called opposition in Syria, when in fact that opposition are largely made up of terrorists. And at the same time, within these meetings, you had people coming in from Libya. But these were people who were also affiliated to the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, and then they come to Tunis as members of a progressive collective which is putting forth, another world is possible, but another world is only possible if you say the truth, and you can't have terrorists within your ranks. And then some people were actually supporting the French military intervention in Mali, some very prominent intellectuals. So that that kind of, the flow of information is such that people are confused. The truth is there, but ultimately the truth is being twisted upside down, and the lie prevails as the new normal, as the truth under the new normal. And people are now, they're now being conditioned to accept that the U.S. government can, under certain circumstances, support Al-Qaeda while at the same time fight Al-Qaeda. It seems to be an absurd proposition, but that is what is happening in the new mindset. Because there hasn't been much, there's been a lot of debate on that, but nobody has said, hey, hello, John Kerry, aren't you in contradiction with the Patriot legislation when you go in and talk to these guys in Syria, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda? Senator John McCain, photo ops with al-Qaeda operatives in Syria. The whole thing is that, I mean, the whole thing is absurd. Why is it that people aren't reacting, saying that that the U.S. government is complicit in some forms with these terrorist organizations? And then it gets back also to 9/11 truth. Okay? Because if you say that Al-Qaeda was behind 9/11 and in fact Al-Qaeda is supported by the U.S. government, you're in a circular discourse there. Whatever the causes of 9/11, but by saying that Al-Qaeda is behind 9/11, you have to make damn sure that you're not supporting Al-Qaeda. And that doesn't transpire in all recent developments. We see that the U.S. government and members of the U.S. government are having overt rather than covert links with the terrorists. And that is a new normal, because previously it was always CIA. It wasn't State Department or U.S. Senate.
Well, I agree completely with your assessment that we have to do our absolute best to break people out of their media-induced psychosis, whereby they accept this new normal. And I think it's extremely important that people do take advantage of sites like the Center for Research on Globalization that have been staunchly and consistently opposed to the war that the practices going on in Libya and Syria and everywhere else that this agenda is unfolding. So why don't we direct people to the website again and tell people how they can access that information?
Well, the Global Research website is at globalresearch.ca. It's also at globalresearch.org. It has a coverage of news as well as background analysis. It's supported by the Global Research TV network as well. We cover the news, but we also provide historical analysis. We have a range of prominent writers, scholars, but we also believe in what we might describe as the democratization of research, that research, analysis, and news is not necessarily fabricated by the pundits, but it often emanates from blog sites. And we've built this project by building a relationship with a number of authors which have their own blog sites, who are not necessarily professional journalists, but ultimately come up with some very incisive understanding. So it's a broad array of scholars, some professional journalists, retired politicians, military intelligence analysts, young college students making remarkable contributions, trade union leaders, lawyers, and it's a broad spectrum, and it's not limited to any particular political perspective. We have people from the left. We have people from the center right. We have liberals. I mean, we're not concerned with how they would themselves designate themselves. What our criteria is really honesty and truth, honesty in reporting. We also have a broad range of viewpoints. But we're also very careful not to publish material which could in any way be misleading. If we talk about conspiracy theories, well, conspiracy theories is how the mainstream media identifies certain strands of alternative media, because they simply go against the stream and they present the truth. But there are also within that alternative media people who actually go beyond that and come up with wild fabrications, which often are misleading. And some of those are actually emanate from they emanate from official sources. Okay, it's a clear case of misinformation or disinformation. I mean, there were strands of articles that said the Boston bombing was run by Moscow, that the Russians were behind it. Well, that is an obvious piece of disinformation, of fabrication. Okay, but then it's inserted into some kind of analytical perspective, and it becomes something which people said, oh, maybe the Russians are behind that. Okay, and that creates an impression on the reader. We're very careful not to publish that type of material. So there's a lot of misinformation. And then there's mainstream lies. And then there's also what I referred to earlier is the kind of progressive, apologies that saying, we think that the United States, is an imperialist power, but we believe that, French military intervention in Mali is a good thing because it goes after the terrorists. That's a nonsensical argument. Okay. Or to say, well, like some scholars or writers will say, that a lot of blood has been shed in Syria. What can we do to encourage the U.S. government to intervene with a humanitarian mandate? Well, that kind of understanding is evidently false because the bloodshed is caused by U.S. foreign policy. And consequently, U.S. foreign policy is criminalized, and so that we're very careful not to get into this kind of fake discourse and so-called progressive discourse, where you criticize U.S. foreign policy and at the same time you support certain elements of U.S. foreign policy.
It is a minefield of information out there, and it is very difficult to find good sources. So for people who do know global research and do know that it is trustworthy, how can they support the site and how can they keep it functioning?
Well, I should mention in that regard, we do not seek any kind of corporate funding or government funding. Some so-called progressive media get funds from the Ford Foundation, okay? A lot of so-called progressive organizations are funded by various organizations. The Rockefeller Group is behind the World Social Forum. It's also behind the Occupy movement. Wall Street supports the Occupy movement. I'm not suggesting that the Occupy movement, some very good people in there, but you cannot confront Wall Street and then ask Wall Street to fund you. Okay, it doesn't make sense. So that in effect, when the Rockefeller brothers fund, establish a window to support progressive organizations, essentially what they're doing is capturing those organizations. They're establishing the limits of dissent. And, that's a subject in its own right. But right from the beginning, we have been self-financing. And we've received small donations from our readers. We sell books, and DVDs, but ultimately it's the donations. And we've received a couple of larger donations as well. It essentially people who have passed away and they've left money in their will to global research, and this has been an act of tremendous generosity, and we have to live up to the memory of those people. And I'm not suggesting that people should necessarily put global research in their will, but what I'm saying is that the couple of people who have done it FAST has made a tremendous difference, and but we also get support from small our readers, $50, $100, $20, some people send in $5 or $10 or $5 a month, and that kind of support is absolutely crucial for our survival. and our independence as a media organization. I should say also that we are largely composed of volunteers. None of the editors are not paid. I've been a volunteer for the last 12 years, almost 12 years. We have a small staff, of course, but because we need to build, the infrastructure of a small research center. All our authors are volunteers without exception. And that is something, it's also their commitment. It's a tremendous commitment on the part of these authors, of their blog sites. Their commitment is to the truth, and they believe. I think there's a feeling of solidarity that when people in a faraway country are affected, whether it's in Japan following the Fukushima disaster, or whether it's in Syria or Libya, or whether it's an environmental disaster. Or whether it's also the issue of the police state apparatus in the United States, where people's phones are listened into and so on. We can dwell on that, but we also realize the interrelationship with all of all these issues. I edit, I would say on average 15 articles a day, and my head just goes, haywire, because I'm editing on the issues of spying on Americans, the surveillance state on the one hand, and then I'm looking into Syria. Then there's the issue of radiation in Japan. There's the nuclear industry in the United States. There's fracking. There's so many different realities. Then there's poverty in Africa. Then there's the austerity measures in Western Europe, the crisis in Greece, the confiscation of deposits. We're dealing with so many realities, and we understand that these are all interrelated. They're part of a new world order. We don't want to start simplifying. There's a tremendous complexity. If people go to our site, they will see that there's an archive. We have an archive of over 30,000 articles, which have been building up since the inception of Global Research on the 9th of September 2001, just 2 days before 9/11. And we started up with essentially it was a makeshift website. I took a crash course in Front Page and FTP, and then I set it up, and then we were online, and we've been evolving ever since. It's that commitment by several thousand authors. Not all the authors have a direct link to us, but we've got, every day we get communications from authors, the texts are sent in. We're always very careful to acknowledge the blog sites of our authors so that they also will get traffic. That is very important, because that's the whole notion of democratizing the media. We don't believe in exclusives. I mean, some alternative media say, no, this is exclusive. You can't reproduce it. We say we'll take material from which is sent to us from authors who have their blog sites. In turn, our texts are reproduced elsewhere. They're occasionally quoted in the mainstream media. And we have to deal with a system which tends increasingly to attempt to control to control the truth ultimately. And so, and we're not necessarily favored, as we know, by the search engines. Okay. We're much more favored, of course, by Facebook, where things circulate on a very spontaneous basis. So an article comes out on Global Research, and then within hours, it may have a few hundred referrals onto Facebook, and after a few days, it may have a few thousand. So that the articles circulate. Some of our articles have reached almost probably 1 million people. We are running more than 100,000 readers a day. Now, if those 100,000 readers a day were to contribute to global research, then we would be in much better shape financially. So I would only request that the 0.0001% of readership, please support us. I know we won't get support from everybody, but at least let's count on the few people who, in those 100,000 plus readers a day who visit our site. The site is free. It's for everybody. We don't believe in any kind of logins. We want the information to spread. And that is the nature of our work. We are now looking forward to bringing in new projects. Just recently, we have launched a radio program which airs out of Manitoba. It's in collaboration with the University of Winnipeg through their community radio station. It's a brilliant set of interviews run by Michael Welsh with very prominent authors and figures, and focusing essentially on different aspects of world events. So that is, in a nutshell, global research. Support global research. Go to globalresearch.ca. We very much rely on that support, because we are not going to ask the Rockefeller brothers to provide us with funding, which would immediately be the end of any kind of independent voice and analysis.
Well, it definitely is the alternative media David versus the mainstream media, and even the pseudo-alternative Goliath. So the people out there who do understand that difference do need to support the small alternatives out there with their dollars. So again, that is available at globalresearch.ca. People can donate, or they can also purchase books and DVDs there to help support the operations. And we should also make clear that that helps to support the GRTV video productions that I help to produce as well. So all of the support genuinely is appreciated. And your analysis is always appreciated. Professor Chostadovsky, thank you so much for your time for today.
Delighted to be on the program.